Hello and welcome back to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I'm an oromaxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado, and I really appreciate you tuning into the episode today. Thanks to all those who have emailed and texted me ideas about topics for the podcast or guests they want to hear from. If you would like to be a guest on the show or know someone you'd like to hear from, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Also, please visit our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, if you'd like to search the podcast in an easier way by topic. We'd like to hear from everyone and really appreciate you guys listening. Keep in mind that everything we're discussing here is based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement everything you're learning here with approved research studies. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Well, welcome to another episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Today I'm with Dr. Michael Markowitz. He's an oromaxillofacial surgeon practicing in the Buffalo area in New York. Mike, thank you so much for joining us again for another episode.
Thanks a lot, Grant, for having me back on again.
Yeah.
It feels like we did this yesterday.
Yeah, I got a lot of great feedback on cleft surgery, and I think you just presented that in an awesome way. So today we were going to try to tackle diagnosing and treatment planning craniosynostosis. We haven't had anyone talk about that on the podcast, so I'm excited to talk about that today. But yeah, could you give us just a brief kind of rundown of maybe the diagnosis part or where you would start with a patient who presents with this?
Yeah. When we talked about a topic for craniofacial, it's interesting because in general, craniofacial surgery includes cleft surgery to a lot of people. Some people like the term now, and I kind of like it too, cranial and maxillofacial surgery, to be more encompassing of what it is. And then if you think about craniofacial surgery, there is all these facets of it. There's cleft surgery, which we talked about last time. There's craniosynostosis, which I think we'll focus on here. But then there's other things. You know, there's parenchyal arch syndrome. There's hemifacial microsomia or craniofacial microsomia. There's Treacher-Collins and Pierre-Robin sequence. And so there's so many things. And what's important is that a lot of these mix together. So in the basic terms with craniosynostosis, there's many ways to classify it, and we'll kind of talk about that. But you have the non-syndromic forms, which are simple, usually single suture craniosynostosis, and then you have the syndromic forms, which is when they have other entities associated with it, which might be cleft, perhaps, you know, Treacher-Collins. You might have a kid with Robin sequence. So, just to simplify it for today, we'll talk about craniosynostosis. And I think just as a background, you know, it's interesting, as you know, this is obviously everyday oral surgery, and, you know, I'm an oral maxillofacial surgeon practicing who does this type of surgery. But I think just as a background, as just for the listeners, and you know this, Grant, there's kind of three specialties that practice this type of surgery. There's predominantly plastic surgery, probably there's a majority of this work in the United States. And then there's ENT does some at some centers upstate here in New York, actually has a good ENT center and a few others around the country. And then probably secondly, it's oral maxillofacial surgery. And interestingly, like head and neck cancer or oral cancer specifically in Europe, if you go to Europe and if you go to Great Britain, if you go to Germany, Austria, the majority of cancer and reconstruction is done by maxillofacial surgeons. And obviously they differentiate in some countries over there, max fax and oral surgeons. We don't do that here. And so similar to oral cancer reconstruction being predominantly performed by our specialty over in Europe and other parts of the world, craniosynostosis is the majority is performed probably by oral maxillofacial surgeons. And in fact, in Great Britain, they have centers of excellence. They have about four or five centers that do this, and all the kids go to that. So, you know, that's a good background. And similar to cancer, we kind of talked about where it's great when we have multidisciplinary teams doing this type of stuff. I think it's interesting how we do, I think in this country, the majority of orthognathic surgery, we'd all agree. You train at the University of Illinois, where you got a phenomenal orthognathic experience with Dr. Maloro and some gifted surgeons there. And it's just always funny how when we enter maybe above the zygoma a little bit, we kind of stop. As you know, I think a sagittal split osteotomy is probably the toughest osteotomy we do in all of craniomaxillofacial surgery. It's very technique sensitive. You're in a big dark hole. I think it's the hardest for a resident or fellow to learn. I think other specialties would agree with that. And it's funny, if you think about craniosynostosis, just to go into that, there's no occlusion to worry about, right? We're not worried about the micro millimeters. We are getting, you know, getting the bite back to our orthodontist like we do with orthognathic surgery. It's really a simple bone that kind of can be shaped and formed in a variety of ways. So that's just kind of a my thoughts on this type of surgery. So I think it's always good to have multidisciplinary teams and multiple good people doing this. And again, like any subspecialty, it's about the content of your training and what you have been exposed to rather than anything specialty specific. So with that, if you think about craniosynostosis and who sees these patients first, probably the majority of them are pediatricians. So that's kind of where the referrals start, is with the pediatricians. And depending on where you are in the country or what center you're at, the pediatricians, the referral patterns usually go to the pediatric neurosurgeons, or they will go to the craniofacial surgeon. Here in the Western New York area, probably the majority of our referrals go to our neurosurgeons first. We have two phenomenal pediatric neurosurgeons here, Vitai Lee and Renee Reynolds, who are partners in crime for cranial facial surgery. And you know, they will often see these patients first. They probably see the majority of the plagiocephaly patients. Obviously, those don't need surgery. We're thinking about combining clinics, maybe if we can find enough time in the week to do so, but they kind of see them first. And we're really working on here, as well as other places, on making pediatricians more aware. Because especially lately, for some reason, we will see late diagnoses. 2 months ago, we had three-year-old twins who had severe sagittal synostosis that was missed. And we do this surgery on craniosynostosis, number one, first and foremost, for functional and concerns and to prevent any neurodevelopmental delay. But the secondary thing is cosmesis, obviously. And both of those get harder to fix as the bones get thicker and the child gets older. And please stop me, Grant, if you have any questions on that topic. But when you evaluate a child with craniosynostosis, obviously they see you. And again, I probably see them secondarily. We had our craniofacial clinic yesterday, which was a Friday. And, you know, I saw a couple of new ones. And most of them saw the neurosurgeon first. So the parents are already prepped on what they'll probably need. But, you know, in evaluating them, first and foremost, it's clinical history, right? So what's the baby experiencing? Are they haven't had any headaches that they can describe? Obviously, if they're young, too young, they can't describe that. Are they having any neurodevelopmental delay? Are they not hitting their milestones? So that's one of the first questions we ask the parents. If they're older, are they starting to babble yet? Are they saying their first words? Have you noticed a delay in those things? Walking, motor function. We now have a neuropsychologist on our team. In fact, when we reaccredited with ACPA, which is our governing body for accreditation, and Buffalo has had a craniofacial center for about 30 years that's been accredited, they actually made us get a neuropsychologist. And so they're very specific on that. And so can they be evaluated and have a cognitive evaluation? Those are things we'll ask. We'll ask if they're in preschool, how are they doing? And if it's a late, you know, late diagnosis. And then, so we want to know the parents' thoughts. We want to know, obviously, the parents, if they have multiple kids, they're probably used to that, used to seeing what normal progression is. What's the family history? Is there any history of craniosynostosis in their family? And is there any history with previous children? Because that is a risk factor for having future kids with that, be it that not that much of a simple craniosynostosis. We want to palpate the skull on the clinical exam. So we want to look for ridging. Now, often you'll have an open suture and you'll have overlap of the sutures, which could be confused with ridging of the skull, but you want to differentiate that from ridging. You might have 2D radiographs. Often we will just go right to a CT. You want to check the fontanelles. And, you know, we always make a big deal, I think, when we're on our medicine rotations or teeth rotations on the anterior and posterior fontanelle being open. That's not as big of a deal as we kind of think. But if they close early, they close early. But, you know, we do want to notice if they are open. Because often if there's a fused suture, that actually fontanelle may actually stay open longer because the brain's going to want to utilize that to grow because there's other areas that where it can't. And then, of course, we'll go to our imaging. And the imaging can include 2D radiographs. But since we use virtual surgical planning on a lot of our open vault reconstructions, we'll go right to a fine detailed 1 millimeter cut CT of the kid's skull. Interestingly, if you think about it, you have to be careful with your timing. If you think you're going to delay surgery for a couple of months, unlike an adult cancer patient or orthognathic patient that you're doing virtual surgical planning on, you have to actually think about the kids growing. So if you get a CT of the kid when they're four and you're going to delay reconstruction maybe till they're 7 months of age, you're going to probably get a new CT because the guides you make, the cutting guides, will not fit that patient. I can tell you, I've run into that early on in my career. So some features of isolated cranial synostosis are, you know, increased intracranial pressure. That's what we're worried about, you know, is the brain trying to grow against a closed container? So are those sutures not open? And in the simplest form, that's what cranial synostosis is. It's essentially one of the sutures, the metoptic, the major sutures we worry about. There's minor ones. The metoptic, the coronal, the sagittal, or the lambdoid are one or many of those prematurely fused. And usually it happens before birth. And if they are, you're going to follow really simply Virchow's law. And Virchow's law, which has been around for a long time now, he stated that essentially you have growth ceases perpendicular to that suture, and you see that, and you get compensatory growth in the other sutures because that brain wants to grow. You know, these kids are growing rapidly.
Yep.
And so, interestingly, you know, Grant, you'll have, say, sagittal synostosis running down the middle of the cranium. If you can just think about what's going to happen there, you're going to have growth ceases perpendicular to that suture, and so they're going to have a very narrow bitemporal, biparietal width, and they're going to usually have elongated anterior posterior growth. They're going to have frontal bossing or occipital bossing, sometimes more than the other. Sometimes they don't have much bossing at all. Maybe the brain's going to try to grow upward, you know, through the top, you know, and that's a different kind of deformity. So those are all things that can show up. And to be honest, it's usually very simple to identify these if you've seen them before, but it's actually very challenging for pediatricians if maybe kid has a lot of hair or if it's just not on their radar.
And real quick, and I'm glad you explained kind of the definition of cranial synostosis with premature fusion of that suture, but what is usually the cause? Is it genetic? Is it something going on in the womb or what happens there?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And our geneticist, who's been around for a while now, Lori Sadler, could probably talk to you about that better than I can. She's great. But syndromic cranial synostosis, we kind of have a thought on the exact defect. And that's usually a fibroblast growth factor defect or the FGFR receptor defects. Those are associated, the FGFR2s are associated with Apert and Crouzon, by far the most common syndromes we see. And then you sometimes have twist one mutations and other kind of mutations as well. But that's interesting, Grant, you know, because parents often ask that exact question, like, why did this happen and can it happen again? And if it's non-syndromic cranial synostosis, often it's just a very happy, healthy baby that, you know, there probably is some sort of reason, but we just don't know.
Got it.
We don't have a good reason for it. Now, the FGFR defects can be associated with maybe isolated metoptic synostosis. We've seen some data that suggests that. And again, if you're talking about genetics, there's many people out there who can describe better than I can, but there's these FGFR3 defects may be associated with the unilateral coronal cranial synostosis. You know, we know sagittal synostosis is more common in males. So these are the little things that point to reasons. We just, like a lot of things in medicine and surgery, we just don't have the exact reason.
Okay. You'll probably get to this, but if at some point you can just kind of touch on which are the most common ones and stuff like that, it would be helpful.
Absolutely. So let's talk about that now. And so the most common is still a sagittal synostosis. Historically, it was sagittal synostosis, unilateral coronal, metoptic, and then a far like fourth would be lambdoid cranial synostosis. And in the syndromic patient, by the way, you know, you could have sagittal and coronal and so on, but most of these patients are non-syndromic. However, I've seen this in my practice. I talk about it with colleagues. We've all seen it. And the data is suggesting from other countries, including this one, in the U.S., that metoptic synostosis is on the rise. And again, I, you know, don't know why that is. Is it because we're diagnosing it better? Are we overdiagnosing it maybe? Are we calling metoptic ridging in some places synostosis, which that's a big deal to differentiate those? You know, we saw a child yesterday, and if you look at it, you know, metoptic, it can be confusing. Now, sometimes think about metoptic synostosis. That's the metoptic suture. You get trigonocephalic looking head, looks like a triangle because growth is stopping perpendicular to the metoptic suture. You get bitemporal, sometimes biparietal narrowing. You get hypotelorism. The orbits are closer together there. And that's all the things that you want to fix. Luckily, metatopic synostosis is probably associated with the lowest risk of neurodevelopmental delay. But what's confusing with metatopic synostosis, and we saw this yesterday with a child actually who was kind of, sometimes it's a dead giveaway, like while they have it, you know, and then that's easy to talk to the parents about that and what they want or what perhaps you can offer as far as, you know, an operation. The metatopic suture can close as early as 2, 3, 4 months of age, right? Physiologically. So if you think about that, you get a child who's maybe 7 months old, they have some ridging, they're a mild deformity. It is extremely confusing to tell the family, is this normal physiology with just some metatopic ridging, or is this truly metatopic cranial synostosis? And everyone has a different conversation with them. The, you know, our neurosurgeons and I have a similar take on it. If it's severe, we'll kind of tell them, okay, obviously from a cosmetic concern and from more importantly, a functional concern, likely, you know, we recommend an operation, but that's always up to the parents. And we have parents with severe metatopic that says, you know, they just don't want it. And then obviously there's some issues there you have to, you know, talk to them about for the child themselves.
Yeah.
And then what if you have a mild deformity? And I don't know the answer to this. I think you could just provide the parents with the data and tell them, you know, the risk of delay. And there's obviously big risk to surgery. It's an intracranial procedure. Likely will get transfused blood if it's an open cranial vault versus an endoscopic. And those are things you talk about with. So in that order, the metatopic fuses early, the sagittal, then the coronal, then the lambdoid, and then you get the minor sutures fusing the, you know, the sphenofrontal, the sphenoparietal, the sphenotemporal, the masculo-occipital suture, all you know, palatal sutures, all the things that we know.
And real quick, the metatopic is also referred to as the frontal that divides the frontal bone. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Good question. So yeah, it's the one that goes right above the frontal nasal junction, and it divides the frontal bones in half.
Okay.
Often kids just have ridging there, you know, and that's really challenging. To, you know, you don't want to treat metatopic ridging, and we don't treat that here, and others try and don't either. But sometimes it gets difficult to differentiate that. And so cranial synostosis that we talked about, you know, growth ceases perpendicular to that suture, and then you get expansion usually of the head parallel to that suture. We always, there's other tests out there that other centers are using, not so much us, but really that, you know, we will always get a good eye exam. We have a couple of good pediatric ophthalmologists here. So always the patient's going for a baseline eye exam. What we're looking for is papilledema. Is there any pressure building up in the back of that eye? And I'm sorry, the back of the, or on their fundoscopic exam. And the optic nerve is a direct extension, as we know, of the brain that goes from intracranial to extracranial. So if there is pressure and showing, if there's papilledema, that is going to be very urgent. And we've had that before. You know, we had a case last year, about this time, actually, they came in, and there's not many true emergencies in craniofacial surgery other than airway stuff. But this was one of them where the kid had a eye exam at school and showed legal blindness, immediately was shipped off to the pediatric ophthalmologist and showed florid papilledema.
Wow.
So that was an emergency. So it was nice. We worked with our center here, the Jacobs Institute. We had rapid printing done of a model. We couldn't use our other vendors. We designed a frontal orbital advancement to really just rapidly give them relief of that pressure. And that child now is doing better. And the tough thing is with any delay or loss of vision, the rule of thumb, and that doesn't always hold 100% true, is that you'll never get back what you lose. And so that's why we don't want to delay diagnosis, because it's hard to ever give a child back what they lost, but you can stop the progression of stuff. So this kid is seeing a little bit better, but he's not 20/20, for example. Other things you'll see is hydrocephalus in some of these patients. You'll see cranial nerve palsies. We had a child yesterday who had nystagmus, ironically, a possible metatopic synostosis. That might not even be related. Some kids could have seizures and epilepsy. That's less common, but that can certainly happen. The things you'll see on the physical exam are you'll see sometimes bulging scalp veins. You'll see sleepiness, high-pitched crying, head banging, seizures like we talked about. You'll see developmental delays. And so as soon as we kind of diagnose the synostosis, we want to say, okay, is there something here that we can point to? Like you mentioned, Grant, a syndrome. You know, and a syndrome is, it's a Greek origin, the word, it just means the run together. So, you know, the contemporary definition is a set of symptoms that consistently present together. think about Crouzon syndrome or Apert syndrome. Most are morphologic in nature, but they often point to an etiology, such as the FGFR defect that we talked about. So if we talk about then what to do, and there's different ways to manage this, there's different timing. Every center has their differences. We will offer, if they're diagnosed early enough, if it's single suture, we will often offer patients an endoscopic procedure, usually up to about 4, maybe 5 months. Places like El Paso or David Yates and David Jimenez are, and David Jimenez is the father of endoscopic surgery for this type of stuff. They will often go later just because, you know, they have a lot of, they're pretty gifted with doing that stuff and have had better luck and experience. But then if it's sagittal synostosis, especially our one neurosurgeon, both have different thoughts on that, our two here, but one of our neurosurgeons, Dr. Reynolds, will offer a modified pieplasty. And that's something I was never trained on, to be honest with you, but I've really come around to like that procedure. And that's essentially releasing the fused sagittal suture, creating kind of barrel staves, which is barrel staves, or just picture a barrel, kind of cutting it open and letting things onion open, and making a few extra cuts to let the brain take over and take over for growth. One of the things we're really working on with our open procedures is to really cut down the incision length on these patients. Everyone has their different ways to make a coronal incision. The zigzag, straight, I think is less commonly used. I use a curve. Everyone does it differently, but in the end, the more curves and zigzags you have, you know, the more surface area you have that incision. It's a longer incision, right? Instead of a straight one. So we all do that, and I agree, but you know, you just have to keep that in mind that you're going to have more surface area for that baby. So usually what we'll do is, you know, so we'll get our CT. We're trying to move some of this planning in-house because, unlike cancer reconstruction where we use custom plates and so on, for formal cranial vault reconstruction, so that's in the baby who's about in the 6-7 month range or older, and where we really had to dismantle the dysmorphic craniofacial skeleton or cranial vault and put it on the back table. Craniotomies by the neurosurgeon. If it's the orbits, it's combined with us. We remove them with them. We take that all on the back table and formally reconstruct it. We will do that with virtual surgical planning. And just like cancer reconstruction, where, you know, it makes my day a lot easier, orthognathic surgery makes our day easier, it's really made it quicker. And our neurosurgeons love it. They have loved here adopting this virtual planning because of the safety it offers too. There's little things like when you have a frontal orbital advancement, that's so for metopic or coronal cranial synostosis, where we actually remove the orbital bandeau and the frontal bones and reshape that appropriately to give the brain more space and to make it morphologically normal, we really can use our cutting guides to be precise. You know, a bad day in the OR is getting into the sagittal sinus. In head and neck surgery, obviously, you know, if you get into the jugular, you can tie it off or you can ligate parts of it. It's not that big of a deal. Even the carotid, a sagittal sinus or transverse sinus exposure is really a bad thing, and it could be fatal for the child. So having modeling and having predictably seen that sagittal sinus during our planning, the neurosurgeons love that. And they kind of give us and me free rein here to do our osteotomies how we want, and I'll show it to them and they'll usually just approve it, making sure that it's appropriate for something bad. Another thing is, you know, if you think about the temporal lobe of the brain, often when you make a cut, the tenon extension, the extension along the lateral aspect of the orbit back, the temporal lobe can sometimes fill in that space in a dysmorphic skull base, such as these kids have. And if you're not retracting appropriately or down deep enough, you can get into that. So virtual planning, I think, like other aspects of what we all do, Grant, implant surgery, orthognathic surgery, whatever, I think has made things more predictable and safer. And we're coming out with a paper right now where we worked with Methodist Houston, James Shaw, and our neurosurgery team, where we've actually, like orthognathic surgery, we look to see how accurate are we at replicating our plans that we've set forth for these.
Got it. And real quick, so your goal is to release that suture that's fused prematurely, kind of reshape the cranium. But then what ends up happening at that suture where you've kind of opened it? How does that growth continue, or does it, you know, do you graft it? How does all that work?
It's a great question. And it's all about kind of that this term, the critical size defect. So in a baby, and I can show many pictures and cases of reconstructing the cranial vault in an infant or in a less than 1 year old, you can have a, we actually will leave big gaps. We'll kind of bone graft some of them, stuff like that, but we'll leave big gap, especially around that suture. Sometimes if it's the metopic or the sagittal, we'll actually put bone back where that suture is, but it'll be loose or there'll be spaces around it for the brain to grow. And in fact, the one thing we look for on an endoscopic approach where we have small incisions and we just, an endoscopic approach now, just to take a step back, is very similar to what was done 100 years ago. The treatment for this, Lane from San Francisco and Lanelong, who's a Parisian or neurosurgeon in about 1901, the procedure that they designed for this was cutting out the fused suture, throwing it in the garbage, and closing up, and that was it. Mm-hmm. The endoscopic procedure we do today is that same exact procedure for the most part with the addition of a helmet. It's the helmet is key.
Okay.
And that's the conversation we have with parents. And I love our neurosurgeons here, and especially Dr. Reynolds, we always joke. And she says she has a very non-biased conversation. And to be honest, when it's an endoscopic procedure, the neurosurgeons don't really need us too much, if we're being honest with ourselves, because they can make little incisions and cut the suture out. But we do it with them because we want to be a team and so on. But for some reason, after conversations with our neurosurgeons, our patients here tend to favor open reconstruction. The drawback, so the morbidity is less, most likely. The papers have shown that. The cost is less. Days in the hospital are less from endoscopic. The drawback is that the kid has to wear a helmet for about a year. They can be expensive. You had to get them changed. And so to answer your question, we literally remove that suture and that's it. And one thing we look to not have done is when the kid comes back, say 2 months later, and it's already ossified or fused, we kind of worry because there's no changes that can happen after that. So the helmet, the orthopedics, which we have two here in Buffalo companies, what it does is it puts pressure on some areas and actually relieves some areas. And over time, it's almost like an Invisalign, right? It's kind of switching and it's moving things to where you want, and then it's banking on that open suture there. In an open vault reconstruction, we'll remove the suture most likely. We might replace it loosely, but things are open. In a seven-year-old, I mean, you know, you could have a couple centimeters width, and we actually want that. We want that brain to fill that space. And the brain, don't forget, the dura and the periosteum are osteogenic. So the pericranium, which we try to really be careful with and fold that back over our fixation, and the dura are osteogenic. So those will help grow bone. Now, one thing we would do in someone who's say 2 years old, and some centers go way early, especially in the syndromic population, they'll switch to distraction. Because in a two-year-old, that critical size defect, so that defect that will heal on its own, is a lot smaller. A two-year-old just don't have the osteogenic and healing potential that a seven-month-old does. And to be extreme, a two-year-old doesn't has much more potential for healing than an adult does. And an adult, if you leave a quarter-sized defect in the skull, that's why you put burr hole covers over it if you're a neurosurgeon during trauma, because it's not going to heal. We would never think about that in like a seven-year-old.
Hey guys, I had a brief interruption to today's podcast. As many of you know, I'm a big fan of using a headlight. I feel like a headlight is so important to being able to distinguish what is what in the patient's mouth. I recently switched to the Spectra headlight that KLS Martin sells, and it's amazing. It's super bright and has a huge field. I highly recommend it. KLS Martin has been kind enough to give us a coupon code for extra batteries and a desktop charger for free with the purchase of the headlight. This is an amazing deal because the extra batteries are extremely helpful to have so that you have them readily charged as a backup option. If your batteries die, your current ones on your headlight, you can swap them out within a matter of seconds for fresh batteries and kind of go on with seeing what you need to see. So the coupon code is capital KLSPHL, all caps, and that's an acronym for KLS Portable Headlight. And it's good until mid-January 2023. So when you order the light through your area rep, just tell them the code and you can get that discount and get those free accessories that are, in my opinion, super important to this light and being able to use it flawlessly. I hope that helps and enjoy the rest of the episode. With the helmet real quick, is it similar, I guess you could say, to Invisalign from the standpoint of, is there like a time period where every few weeks or months they're like rescanning the head and looking at the growth and doing a new helmet, or how does that work?
It's great. It's so funny. I never made this comparison before until today, but I think it's a very similar thing. Yeah, there's no ClinCheck. Like there isn't, I don't know if it's trademarked, if I could use that term, but there's no rescanning. They will rescan the kids sometimes, and you're exactly right. And they'll see, okay, this little boy or girl is, we're getting a really good movement here, or their AP is good. They really look at the cephalic index and the other parameters, and they'll look at what they want to get. It's very similar to Invisalign, to be honest, where it's like, where do we want to go and how do we get there? And they will often have to rescan and do that, especially if compliance is not good. You know, the helmets are just like Invisalign. This is a great comparison, and I never thought about it. It's very similar in that if there's good compliance, it works great. If there's bad compliance, we're going to be signing that kid up for an open procedure, just as I guess in braces, you're going to sign them up for some braces, you know, as opposed to Invisalign.
Right. Well, that's helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if we move down the road, so let's think about the procedures we do for these. And if you think about sagittal synostosis, we talked about an endoscopic procedure at a certain age. And we published this recently in a clinic, kind of our paradigm. And then a kind of that modified pieplasty, which is we use a pretty small incision, coronal incision, and we'll make multiple cuts. And then once we get, there's a variety of procedures I'll do for, you know, there's switch cranioplasty where you take kind of the parietal bones and you switch them from side to side, really develop that cephalic index. There's other procedures we'll do and we kind of tailor it. Like parents often ask, because they're very intuitive now, parents, they'll go to multiple centers and they'll say, well, so-and-so does this at their center for sagittal synostosis. And what do you guys do here? And then I always say we tailor the procedure to the patient. So there's no set procedure we do for patients with that. But if you look at now, lambdoid is tough, a separate topic because it's so rare, lambdoid synostosis.
Okay.
Metopic or unilateral coronal or coronal synostosis. So if you think about metopic, you're going to have narrow eyes, you're going to have hypotelorism, bitemporal, bicarotid narrowing. If you're going to have unilateral coronal synostosis, you're going to have that harlequin deformity, as it's called. And that, think about the harlequin, you know, the clown. If you think about how the upper lateral aspect of the orbit is pushed up, that makes sense because the coronal suture is pulling everything that way. And it really does pull that eye up. And that's one of the things I've tried to focus on as I develop my career is closing down that increased intraorbital volume, which I think is so noticeable after surgery, even if you don't close it down enough. And I've done bone grafting. You do differential release of the bandeau. If you have bicoronal or bilateral coronal synostosis, think about that. It's just going to be a very flat forehead. Things won't be as projected. And then to fix that, metopic unilateral coronal or bilateral coronal, it's the same procedure. It's a frontal orbital advancement. And the FOA, you know, essentially the neurosurgeon does a bifrontal craniotomy, removing the frontal bones. And then with our help, everyone does it differently. Probably a lot more do it better than we do. But our system here is our neurosurgeon and their resident, while they are reflecting the brain from above, we're reflecting the intraorbital contents and I'll take a saw, usually a reciprocating saw, and go from the orbital side with the neurosurgeon always talking to us, and we'll start to release that bandeau from the anterior skull base. And there's a move that like Ramon Ruiz was very good at teaching where you kind of drop the saw and you go through the frontal zygomatic suture, and then you still want to keep your tip of your saw intracranial, and then you go laterally in what's called a tenon extension. One thing I'm doing here, and this is a suggestion from some colleagues in Seattle, is that I'm really trying to take a lot of times now that lateral orbit cut as inferior as possible, because you can imagine when you advance that orbit, there's a big gap between the native inferior orbit that's set and then where you advance it. And that usually fills in with bone, but I think it looks nicer when you capture more of the lateral orbital rim. And that's what Posnick would describe even in his textbook. And it was always very, very nice, I thought. So that's the procedure really for a frontal orbital advancement. If we talk about lambdoid synostosis, that's interesting because the majority of what is thought to be lambdoid craniosynostosis is not. It's the most rare one we see. I've seen, I think, one in fellowship and two as a practitioner, you know, here in our center that has truly been Lambent's and stenosis that has to be released. And if you think about the deformity, that has to be differentiated with positional plagiocephaly. And 9 times out of 10, it's positional plagiocephaly. And this is mainly a clinical diagnosis that you could see the kid, you kind of, hopefully they don't have a lot of hair. If you look from above, if it's positional plagiocephaly, they're going to have a parallelogram shape of their head. And just think of what that means. If things are pushing the back of the skull forward, so there's one side goes forward, that side of the ear goes forward, and actually you will have that side, you'll have ipsilateral frontal bossing. And if you think about how that looks from above, that looks like a parallelogram. And Joe Grust described this in a few nice papers before he passed away. If you think about lambdoid synostosis, it's a trapezoid look, and meaning that the ear, think about, things are being pulled towards that fused lambdoid suture. Actually, you have retrusion of the forehead on that side. You have stuff goes forward, or the head looks forward from above on that side. The ear comes back towards that fused suture. The other side is normal. So now you have a trapezoid look there.
Okay.
No need usually to get imaging on that unless you have suspicion that might be true lambdoid. But here we're thinking about combining clinics. Unlike in, say, fellowship, my neurosurgeons see the majority of plagiocephalies, and I'm definitely okay with that. And if parents are interested, if it's severe enough, they can get helminth therapy for that. That's fine. It's a non-operative condition. So it really, the risk of developmental delay is almost none. So I think that kind of covers the majority of non-syndromic craniosynostosis. And I don't know, Grant, if you have any questions about that for non-syndromic at all.
I mean, a couple of questions. One is, just what is the most common way these patients are found out? Is it just a parent seeing a baby and their head being misshaped? Is it the going in for the doctor checkup and the doctor notice it? Or is it seizures? Like what's happening?
Yeah, great question. Probably different on what area of the country you're in, you know, rural and city and so on. You know, these kids are so rare and everyone fights over them as far as who wants to operate on them, that I always joke, no one's going to be walking around with craniosynostosis, and some surgeons only grab them off the street and get them in the operating room. But they're missed sometimes. Most commonly, it's often on birth. You know, the pediatrician will see them. Obviously, kids look pretty different sometimes on birth. You know, until things kind of play out. You know, I know you have experience with that. And so it's often the pediatrician will say, hey, things are wrong. And the parents know what to look for, and they'll point it out to the pediatrician. We've had it where, you know, very good pediatricians and concerned parents are saying, hey, my kid, something just doesn't look right. And finally, they'll send it to craniofacial surgeon or the neurosurgeon, and it'll be a late diagnosis. And we've had that several times, and other places had that too. But most commonly, to answer your question, is the pediatrician and the parents that find that out. Usually very early on too. Especially think about it, in a very severe deformity, it's pretty noticeable.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you're doing the endoscopic technique, you're making us, I guess it depends what suture it is, but let's say if it's for the sagittal, you're making a kind of a smaller incision going in there. And then is it just release or cutting that suture, or are you actually removing a segment of the bone, or what's happening?
Yeah. So good question. So it's removal.
Okay.
You want to create a really good size gap there. I think 2 to 3 centimeters usually. Let's say for a sagittal, if you can picture a sagittal synostosis, depending on the morphology of the child, you'll have like a small incision anteriorly where the anterior part of the suture, almost for the anterior fontanelles. And often that is a helpful thing to get your instrumentation in there. There is a special retractor that Barone and Jimenez designed. Again, they're the pioneers of this procedure, to where when you make your incisions, it's kind of picture a retractor that goes, and it one goes above the bone, one goes below. And it's easy to strip. We'll take a long kind of bovi needle, fairly long one, a special kind of bovi tips. We'll have good light. This retractor has lighting on it. And through that, you can go subgaleal, and you can actually dissect all the way till your other incision. And the harder part is more sometimes, and the dangerous part is going under the bone, obviously releasing the dura from the underside. And once that's released on the top and on the bottom there, most often you can take a heavy scissor actually and just cut out the suture. Yeah. And if you can imagine, say we've had a case recently, multi-suture synostosis, that we said, okay, let's try to do this endoscopically early on in life. I think the first 2 weeks of life, and you can make a bunch of, instead of making a big coronal, make a bunch of small incisions, maybe near the superior aspect of the coronal. The key thing is to be able to get your dissection down at the very inferior aspect of that suture to remove the whole suture. The same with the metopic, you can make it just behind the hairline, almost like a brow lift incision, but smaller in length. And then you can dissect down in the subgaleal plane and then in the supradural plane just beneath the bone as well. The key thing is to take that cut all the way down to the nasal frontal junction and remove that suture altogether.
Okay. Yeah, that is really helpful. For those listeners who are kind of interested in the training, and I know we did an episode with you about this beforehand, but learning all this stuff is in a fellowship, and that's a couple of years after residency, or remind us how your path went.
Sure. I think mine was similar and maybe a bit different than others where I did residency. And again, to do cranial facial surgery, if you look at the ACPA parameters of care, you had to have training in ENT plastic surgery or oral maxillofacial surgery. And again, fellowships, kind of talked about this at Amos last year, where, I actually interviewed for a bunch of plastic surgery craniofacial fellowships. I just feel incredibly lucky to train with Ramon Ruiz, who was in Orlando and was just a gentleman. When I was looking at other programs, but in the end, I did his fellowship and was so lucky because it was an amazing craniofacial cleft experience, but also a very good orthognathic experience as well. And so I did that first. I trained at Oregon for residency and just got, a very comprehensive experience in oral maxillofacial surgery. And then I just hit the lottery, and then I was able to go train with Dr. Ruiz in Orlando at the Children's Hospital there, where I was a cranial maxillofacial surgery fellowship, did a lot of transcranial procedures, and then actually did an extra year. And again, hitting the lottery, I went to Jacksonville at the University of Florida and trained with Rui Fernandez and others there in head, neck, and microvascular surgery. And I think these techniques, I really mix them all the time in cancer surgery and craniofacial surgery. And then, of course, continuing just being lucky, got to go to Chicago and work with just an amazing team there at residence. And Michael Maloro was the chair and recruited me there. And Michael's a good friend of mine. And I got lucky to go there. Same place where you trained and worked with Alexis Olson at Children's and so many other good people. And then obviously got recruited here to Buffalo to be, chair and also to co-direct the craniofacial team. And we're taking our first, actually, I think I may have mentioned this, our first craniofacial fellow, who's David Best, coming out of Michigan. He's the chief resident there right now. And we're super excited for that. And then actually, similar training backgrounds, we're having the chief resident at Columbia is named Kevin Lee, who's just really, like David, a really good person, and we're excited to have him. He's going to do our head neck fellowship next year at Roswell Park Cancer Institute, and then he's going to stay on and do a craniofacial fellowship as well, and he'll be our second ever craniofacial fellow here. So again, I've always been hesitant in any fellowship to start one or to be a part of one, because you want to make sure it's good and you want to make sure you offer people a good experience, and all the fellowships in our specialty are just really phenomenal. So it's really hard, cancer, there is no shortage of out there. And so that kind of walks in your door, especially as an oral maxillofacial surgeon, as we all know that in Chicago, I got really busy with cancer. Here, I got fortunate enough to get really busy very quickly because, there's so much of it. I think the difference with craniofacial surgery and why there's so many politics around it, and there is with cancer too, but is unfortunately, and if parents only knew, I always say, if parents only knew how much surgeons fight over their kids' lips and their heads, it'd be incredible. That there's just so much less of it. There's so many people trying to do it and do good work. And I think we all, in the end, want to just do good surgery and help out patients. But there's so little of these cases out there. So in Chicago, you have 5 ACPA approved teams, similar to New York City. You have, and then you have others around the city who are just doing the surgery, right? And they're not part of a approved team, which is fine. And so, you know, there's a lot of people trying to do this stuff. So if you're trying to sign up and do this, go ahead and do it. And you can contact me anytime, but by phone or email to talk about it. And I will talk forever about it, because in the end, even if you don't do the surgery, I think it makes you a much better surgeon in whatever you do. I think when you do head and neck surgery, it makes you more comfortable around the airway. It makes you comfortable around vessels and so on. And I think being a good craniofacial surgeon, I could tell you, I think makes you a better cancer surgeon. It makes you better on transcranial approaches, on skull-based approaches. You can combine techniques. You can combine grafting techniques with free flap techniques. And I think all these things just make you better. So you definitely will never do a fellowship and be sorry you did it. I haven't met anyone who said, well, I wish I did not take that year. One of the knocks is on doing a fellowship is that you're losing income, right? And that's for sure the truth. I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of more, oral surgery is a very lucrative specialty. And I was joking last night with a mentor of mine that my retirement plan is to, you know, go do implants and teeth in a few years. But, you know, I think Mark Engelstedt told me this when I was one of his residents at Oregon. He was my program director, and Mark's very thoughtful. He's like, when you're 50, you know, you're not going to look back at that year you took off and say, well, maybe, you know, my bank account could be so much more right now if I just maybe went to go work that year and didn't do a fellowship or two. You know, I mean, in the end, your bank account would probably be the same. You'll probably have the car you want, the house you want, whatever things that make you go, you know, and are important to you. You'll have the family you want, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's just worthwhile to go do it and not look back. So I'm just a big proponent of fellowships. Obviously, there's orthognathic fellowships now. You know, there's such good ones out there in Carolina with Brian Farrell and these others, and in Toronto and so on. And that was very frowned upon, you know, when I was a resident. You know, why would you do a fellowship in orthognathic surgery? Well, I think it's very similar to otolaryngology, you know, and doing, why would you do a laryngology fellowship or a rhinology fellowship? I mean, I think extra training, you can never, you know, I think there's no excuse for that. And I think to me, I was talking with one of our surgeons yesterday, our plastic surgeon on our team, that in the end, I think wherever you go, you just want volume. I think you want volume, but you also want to learn how to do stuff. The reason you do a fellowship, I mean, there's many people who come out of really good programs and can do a neck dissection and can do a free flap. And they're super talented people who can do clefts. I've seen this so many times with gifted surgeons, but it's like an orthodontic residency. You know, you don't go to orthodontic residency for two, three years to learn how to put on braces. You go for the treatment planning, right? So the reason you do a cancer fellowship, I think, is to learn when to treat, when not to treat, how to work with your radiation oncologist, how to work with your medical oncologist, how to present a tumor board, how to stage a patient, what procedure to do on a patient, and when not to operate on them, and also how to run the social concerns of a cancer patient. The same thing for cleft and craniofacial surgery. You know, we had our resident team yesterday in craniofacial clinic. We talked about this when we grabbed lunch, that it's learning when, why to do stuff. The reason you do a craniofacial fellowship, I think, is, and I was so lucky to do such a good one in Orlando, is not how to cut a cleft lip, but not how to put a palate together. And to be honest, not make a coronal incision and to put pieces of bones together with some resorbable fixation. I think it's when to do it, the timing on it, how to work with your colleagues on your craniofacial team, how to speak the same language, how to talk to them, and how to give patients, kids, and their families the best outcome possible. So that's my quick two cents on fellowships. And I'm always happy to talk about it more if anyone's interested.
I really appreciate you breaking that down for us. One issue I think with this specialty of pediatric craniofacial clefts, craniosynostosis, is there's just not many programs. And so most residents don't get much exposure to this stuff. It's helpful for us to talk about this, but then also for there to be avenues for residents and dental students to kind of check this out and get a feel for it. Because it's just something that isn't as present, you know, as orthognathic surgery and implants and every other type of thing we do.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point, Grant. I mean, And you don't know what you don't know, right? So if you don't know what's out there, I think social media has, I'm not that good at this and I need to be better at publishing cases and so on, but it's brought what we can do in any specialty, plastics, OMFS, ENT, out there to residents more. But you're exactly right. If you don't go to a comprehensive program or even a program that does cleft surgery or craniosynostosis surgery, how do you know what's out there? And how do you know that you like it? Mm-hmm. And so that's a great point. And that's, I don't know how to get that better. I think one thing is to just, I think it's very important for mentorship. You've been lucky, I think, in your career. I've been so fortunate in my career to have good mentorship. So you might not know what to do and how to get there. But so for me, it was, you know, Brian Bell, I think I told this story before, when I sat there and I was a second year saying, okay, well, we're going to set you up to go do this, this, and this, and see this. And after that, I was hooked. You know, I went down to Jacksonville, went down to Orlando, and I was signed up, you know, and we offer the same thing to our residents here. And then at the same time, you want to make sure you can do this stuff after you're done, right? And practice this. And that's the hard part sometimes. So,
yeah,
you know, that's where it's a leap of faith sometimes. And to be honest, there's just, you know, there's like 30 plastic surgery, if not more now, I believe, plastic surgery-based craniofacial programs. And if you ask a lot of the fellows who come out of those programs, if they're honest, I showed this data because I looked it up actually the year I applied. Most of the big programs, the ones that we all know about, the Seattle, the, you know, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the NYUs, those types of programs, they're going to find a job somewhere, but there's not a lot of openings even for them in this. You know, think about it. I mean, if I'm here doing this type of surgery, to be honest, we're looking to hire possibly someone who can help out with this stuff here, but there's not a ton of it to go around. So it's a good question. And I think in the end, that's why I think find the fellowship that not only offers you this, that can maybe offer you more orthognathic surgery is a really good idea.
I like that. That's awesome. And I really appreciate you kind of taking some time to run us through craniosynostosis and some of the basics of treatment planning and treating these patients. If there's listeners who have kind of further follow-up questions or want to get kind of go more in depth with this, are you okay if they reach out to you or what do you think?
Always. Yeah, they can email and email is usually the most direct to get a hold of me. And then we could certainly set up a time to talk. Yep, always happy to do that. I'll say I feel bad. I know we're out of time, but we never got to talk about syndromic craniosynostosis, which is a whole other topic on its own and how to manage the syndromic patient. So
next episode, we're going to do it.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get to that sometime. I totally forgot. We talked so much about a non-syndromic and then I probably babbled a bit too much about my views on fellowship, but we'll have to do that. But absolutely. And Grant, I think it's impressive. I think I told you before we hopped on here, we're sitting here on a Saturday doing this. You have a busy practice and a busy family life. I am shocked. I didn't know this. And then all so many residents, including our own, who have said, oh, I heard you on Everyday Oral Surgery. And, you know, so it's how popular this is in the pre-doc population of people, those trying to do oral maxillofacial surgery and also in the residents. So I've started to listen to them, you know, when I go on a run or working out or something like that. I think you have got some amazing guests on. Thanks for plumbing it with me a little bit today. And I just, in talking to you last night on a Friday night trying to set this up, the work you put in this is really impressive. So thanks for putting this all together.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. And thank you for slumming it with me because I'm just the average Joe who has pretty low exposure to craniosynostosis. So this has been super helpful for me. But I would love to reconnect with you in the next week or two and maybe do part two where we talk about the syndromic aspects of this.
Sounds good. We'll definitely have to do it.
All right. Sounds good. Have a great day. I appreciate you.
You too, Grant. Thank you.
Yeah, bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Once again, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, guests you'd like to hear from, or if you yourself would love to be a guest, please, please email me or text me at 720-441-6059. And also just love hearing from people if you enjoy the podcast or, you know, learn something from it or talk to a friend or connected with someone because of the podcast. That just makes my day. So please shoot that correspondence over to me and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you.